Hey, are you looking to experience something new? I am. Been fantasizing about surprising your partner with an adventurous new toy or inspiring adult movie? Always. Well, here's an offer that'll make it even easier to make your dreams come true. Go to adamandeve.com, and for a limited time only, you'll get 50% off just about any item. Oh, but that's not all. Oh, no. When you select that one item for 50% off, you'll receive 3 free adult DVDs, plus a free extra gift. So secret, even I don't know what it is. Ha! And to top it all off, and this is my favorite, they will even throw in free shipping on your entire order. I know, right? Free shipping. So all you've got to do is type in offer code SEXNERD at checkout. Get that dirty mind of yours to adamandeve.com today for this special offer. 50% off one item, 3 free DVDs, a free extra secret gift, and free shipping. Just use offer code SEXNERD at adamandeve.com. That's SEXNERD. Oh, give in to temptation, you guys. adamandeve.com.
Now entering nerdist.com.
Hi, Naughty Monkeys. It's me, Sandra, from this podcast. Ah, welcome to the show. Hi. Oh, my goodness. So many of you are giving me such shit for not podcasting regularly lately. But hey, okay, it's Friday when I'm recording this. Hopefully it'll drop on Friday and then it'll be technically in a week. And then it'll be math. Well, I'm sorry. And I love you. Moving on. Oh, my goodness. So this episode was such a blast with Dr. Chris Donahue. Donahue? No, that's not his name. Chris Donahue. He is brilliant. He's been on the show before, the cheating episode, and a couple others. And I just adore him. And his new book, Sex Outside the Lines, looks friggin' fantastic. I really recommend it because I've heard him speak on this topic, and just he lays out a vision of sexuality and gender that is so liberating. So I enjoyed the talk. I hope you enjoy the talk as well. Before we get into it, really just one thing, which is I'll be in New York on October 10th. It's next week. And Saturday, October 10th, I'll be live podcasting from New York's Union Hall. It's part of New York Comic Con Super Week. I don't know what the topic is. I don't know who my guests are, but you know, I always come through. There's always something crazy on stage. A few of the things that this is just a total tease because I don't know what it's actually going to be, but I'd like to see if I can get someone to talk about unicorns, especially when it comes to couples looking for a unicorn, you know what I'm saying, or orgasmic meditation. That's something we haven't talked about and is a little controversial for some. And then I know someone who runs a sex party space in New York, so I might see if they're available to come. Just a few things I'm brainstorming. Basically, it's going to be $14. You can go to New York. NewYorkSuperWeek.com and get tickets to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast for October 10th. And I hope to see you there because I love seeing, really, over the years, so many friendships have been made just by people being really friendly at the live shows. I mean, really, it's like our own version of a high-ranking OkCupid scores. Like, we all just get along. So please come out. It'll be so much fun. And that's pretty much it. I appreciate you. And, you know, I'm getting back in the game, feeling good. And this is the part where I just start talking and don't know how to end. And after 4 years of doing this podcast, I still sometimes, go blank. And this is one of those moments, but hey, sex, right? Can't get tired talking about sex. Mm-mm. Oh no. Okay. Have fun. Goddamn fun.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Chris Donahue, from the first moment that we sat in a Jeep together to talk about cheating, you've blown my mind.
Thank you.
Even casually. This is exciting. Are you noticing that I talk differently the minute the mic is on?
Are you noticing that I do as well?
Oh. Yeah, like we've been just chilling for a while and suddenly it feels weird. I feel like you need a podcast. Because
You just...
I'll just come on yours a lot. How about that?
Okay, that sounds great.
I'll just be a frequent guest and then really everyone's great. Happy.
I clocked it. We only live 20 minutes away from each other. It's not too bad.
No. Yeah. What area are you in?
East Side area.
I need to move further east. I love it over there. The energy, phenomenal. That's where I do most of my writing. I go write on the East Side. It inspires me. Yeah, for sure. I go to coffee shops in Los Feliz or Silver Lake, and I'm really inspired by seeing the diversity of people, style, and families, like mom and dads with their babies, you know, hanging from them and tattooed and different styles of relationship. And I love the nonconformity over there. It really helps inspire me to push my work forward.
Wow, that's fascinating considering I live over there and I go, God, it's so whitewashed over here.
Come to the West Side and you'll be horrified at how much more whitewashed it is for sure.
That's true. I actually grew up in Santa Monica.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. But I went to public school, and so there was a huge diversity there. But Santa Monica as a whole, the where all the tourists go,
yes,
and all the young MTV executives live. Like, yes, it's pretty. I hate to say white because it's not even that. It's not even that it's ethnically white. It's that it's homogenous.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the issue.
Yeah, that doesn't inspire me. Venice is a really good area, but no, East Side. I think you've been embedded in it too long. You don't even know the value of what you have around you anymore.
I'm rarely around people that look anything like me. You know, I miss a time. I hate being institutionalized, being in institutions like public school, but it did force a lot of people together.
Yeah, it does. And we were talking earlier about television, and you just said you don't see a lot of people like you. You definitely don't see yourself on television, I'm sure.
No. It's gotten better since childhood. I remember the first time I saw a Asian, European woman on TV. Mm-hmm. I freaked out a little bit. It was Smallville.
Oh, I know you're talking about the female character.
Yep, Swedish Japanese.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, there's a new show on network television called Fresh Off the Boat, and it's just a lot of Asian stereotypes.
Oh, it's painful, right?
Yeah, it's so offensive to me. I am so grossed out by it.
Yeah. I mean, I had a very intensely Vietnamese aunt, and there's a lot of hilarity that ensues with... You can make fun of your Asian family quite a lot. And I watched the show and was like, ooh, they're not doing us any favors. Like, this is not even the fun. This isn't fun.
That's some white people's only experience of that culture. And again, it's reinforcing the stereotypes that they're already, problematically aware of. So not pushing any boundaries, that show.
No.
Sadly.
But here we are. We're pushing boundaries.
Yes, we're pushing the lines.
With your book, Sex Outside the Lines by Dr. Chris Donahue, host of Bad Sex and Sex Box and probably more shows. Because you're an attractive celebrity therapist.
Well, thank you. That's a good intro. I like that.
Ah, you're welcome. No, you've been on the show before.
Yes.
You were wonderful to speak with me after that horrible shooting in Santa Barbara with the pickup line guy going haywire. And that juicy episode on cheating.
Which, by the way, you have a phenomenal fan base because I'll do podcasts and I do take note as to which ones have people that circle back and reach out and want to discuss further. And you have a really great group where you're one of the shows where people months and even years later will circle back and be like, I heard what you said, and ask me more questions about it. It's a really engaged group. It's phenomenal.
Thank you.
Kudos to you.
Thank you. No, when I first started the podcast, I was so afraid because I didn't know what I was getting into on many levels. And I've just learned over the years that I'm lucky to have and connect with amazing listeners.
Yes.
So
more about me.
More about you. Yeah. No, it's
kidding.
Good. No, what's cool though, is that I have different listeners and I would say that not every guest gets that kind of feedback.
Okay.
And so it's not like, oh yeah, anyone that comes to my show gets hooked up. It's that you're resonating strongly with people and that's powerful.
Yeah, that's good. And sometimes because of the work I do, sometimes it's a good resonation. Sometimes it's a bad, but I think both of them are actually good and important because I think it's the things that trigger us and make us uncomfortable that really locates where our work is and locates where the cultural issues lie. So when people read my book, and they reach out and they're like, wow, I don't agree with this. That made me uncomfortable. I say, good, sit with that. Think more about that. Research that. That's where the work lies.
Yeah. You're all about breaking out of labels.
I am. I think, you know, as a therapist, we're trained to try to label everything. Mm-hmm. And to label anything, I think, is to remove the humanity, the complexity. It's to really reduce them down to one pathologized component of who they are. Mm-hmm. And people buy into that. And they walk around wounded because of that. And my work is about challenging diagnostics and labels and saying, you're bigger than that. And a lot of times, I think difference, psychology loves to frame difference as disorder. If you're different, it must be an illness or a problem or a disorder, as opposed to saying, look at the beauty and creativeness in what you're doing. So I'm a fan of what I sometimes call like resistance and nonconformity, because I think health often lies on the outside.
Health lies on the outside.
On the margins, outside the lines.
So if you have an asymmetrical haircut.
You are just saturated in...
You're so healthy.
I love that you just made a hairstyle reference. Oh, that's phenomenal. But you know what? That's actually an interesting point. Most of us have very, what do you say? Balanced, symmetrical, expected haircuts. Conformity at its worst. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say it's one of the last flagging tools, I think, for queer culture.
You're killing me with this. That is so brilliant. Talk more about that. That's a book.
That's a book?
How queer are you? And it's all about your hairstyle.
Oh, God.
Hair diagnostics.
I'm 0% queer then. I'm like in braids all the time.
I don't know. Braids is not that typical. And braids at your age, that's rebellious.
That's true.
You're not
that's
15
true.
Anymore. No. And you don't care.
I'm trying to work the she looks kind of Native American angle. You know?
Why? What does that mean for you? You're really making me laugh. This is funny.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
My hair is very heavy.
Okay.
And long hair is much easier than short hair. Mm. And so if I wanted to flag for my people, I would have like multiple colored hair and asymmetrical action and weird bangs. But you know what, Chris?
What?
You know what?
Tell me.
That takes a lot of fucking work.
Oh, it does. So you're saying that because my hair is short, I can't imagine having long hair. Because I feel like there's thought involved in that. I don't want to think about that.
Well, there's a point where you hit the opposite spectrum, opposite end, where you like circle back around. Like your hair's really short, and so you're kind of the ink blot. You're Rorschach'd for anything.
Yeah. I kind of feel like you just called bullshit on my queer identity because I have the haircut I have, and I'm literally going to now be thinking about this for days. If I should find more congruence in my hairstyle with the identity I like to have out in the world.
Oh, I think it's just about flagging. It's just about. Like I had this really interesting conversation with a trans woman a while ago, and I was checking in to see if I was offending her and stuff. And I think I've said this on the podcast at some point. Oh yeah. We just released one on gender queer identity. And
where was I? That is such an important part of the work I do.
The bigger question is, where was I? I was in Sydney, Australia.
which by the way, I have not been, but can I tell you that's on the list of like the top one place I need to go immediately. I love and this is a horrible racist thing to say, but I love Australians. Like I hate saying things like that, like ethnic definers like that.
I love every
single one of them is phenomenal. No, but you know what's interesting? Some of the coffee shops I hang out with have high concentrations of people here from Australia, either having lived here or visiting.
Huh.
Yeah. And so I
like you just have a great time.
I've always had really interesting conversations. I think it's actually, it probably falls under the label of if you're not American, it's going to be something of interest because I'm bored of the same old narratives that I hear here. Mm-hmm. And so to go to a place that in my mind is so distinct is just really fascinating to me.
Anne has a much more cohesive sex ed system.
Yeah, which if you compare it to ours, I think that's like an easy thing to do. You know, anyone's that's any step beyond us is going to be doing far better. Ours is horrible.
Yeah, I guess we're kind of in last place almost.
Oh, it's horrific.
America.
It's horrific. Yeah.
Back to you.
Yes.
And just because sometimes I'll listen to my podcast because I'm great. No. And realize that I didn't finish my point. So just for the person who's like, what was she going to say? The trans woman I was talking to?
Sorry, yes.
No. I want to talk to you. Yeah. But I mentioned passing around dating because they were having a hard time dating. Because they pass. Like you just wouldn't get any sense that there was anything different gender-wise going on there. It was just like, oh, there's a chick. And she was like, that might offend some people. And I totally get that. Absolutely.
Yes.
But if you're trying to attract people to you that are interested in whatever you're throwing out there, then I think passing, like I pass for heterosexual, like innocent, quiet. People think that I'm that all the time. That's what I pass as, right. But I am not that.
Right.
Unless I'm like feeling kinky, you know, and then that's like my kink is to be right. Like, oh, ooh, ah, you know, like, but you know, that's only if we're dating. Shut up. So I think it's important to choose your flagging.
Yeah. I, you're nailing it for me in an interesting way as well. I, for a long time, didn't have an intention in what I was trying to pass as, but I wasn't liking what was being flagged. And I was often being mistaken as like a party guy. I have mm-hmm. a lot of tattoos. I go to the gym, I have big biceps, and people were assuming that I was part of the bar nightclub scene mm-hmm. here in Hollywood. And so that's what I was kind of attracting. And like, I don't drink. I don't enjoy bars. I feel very out of place. The kinds of topics I like to talk about aren't popular there. And I had to look at that. Like, what was I passing as and how was I presenting myself and mm-hmm. where am I spending time? But the passing thing is interesting for trans because not all people that identify as transgender are trying to go from one pole to the other.
Like absolutely. Male, female, vice versa,
right? Mm-hmm. So some of them to pass is to not pass because they're occupying some other third, fourth, or fifth mm-hmm. space that has no signifier. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting topic, but it's a great one. It's really important. There's something liberating too. You know, when I work with clients that want to talk about transgenderism for themselves, sometimes their minds are blown and they're really freed when I say that because they come in thinking, well, if I was born and diagnosed as male and that's not comfortable, I guess I'm female. And I say, well, or you're 150 other things because there's a multitude of options. It's not just male or female. And that's really liberating for some people because not everyone is meant to be one of those two options.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. Was it you that was using this term, like liberation theory? Is that
yeah.
something?
Yeah. Cause I'm trying to develop a psychological theory called liberation centered therapy. And it's mm-hmm. based in that notion, liberating yourself from labels, diagnostics, gender. I mean, I find all that so oppressive.
Taking yourself out of the box, maybe the sex box.
It's, yeah. Interesting reference. Yeah. The sex box or sex outside the lines. Yeah. Recurring themes in my career.
Sorry. There's a show that you were just hosting called
yes,
Sex Box.
I host a show called Sex Box and sadly America wasn't ready for it. The show didn't get to run in its entirety because some religious right-wing groups got advertisement pulled and it was losing money and it got pulled from the air. Yeah. America's not ready to, you know, again, like we're obsessed with sex and we'll talk about it a lot, but we're not ready to talk about it in a really honest, liberated, healthy way. We want to talk about it as danger, danger, danger.
God, I feel like that's some form of like financial terrorism. Like when you, you silence somebody, I mean, there is a certain amount of.
And it's a lose-lose.
Sabotage.
Yeah. It's sabotage. It's silencing. That's a brilliant, powerful word. Financial terrorism. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's no way to fight that. Money and television are go hand in hand and money can really annihilate something. Yeah. We lost the yeah. battle. We tried.
But I have to ask this, even though it's not even on, because it'll probably, you know, people will probably be able to pirate episodes or whatever.
Yeah. I think it might be on their website still.
Cool.
WeTV.
Cool. I saw little clips of it, mm-hmm. but I didn't see full episodes.
Mm-hmm. Too sexual
for you. Idea is that, and I kind of don't quite understand this. Like I get it, but I don't quite understand it. That you have couples who want sex therapy counseling to have sex in a box, in a room that is a box on stage. And so that in the afterglow of their lovemaking, then you and two other sex therapy experts.
And that's a loose use of that word. So let's dive into this.
I mean, you're like super PhD, know
yeah.
a lot of
the
shit.
The other two on my panel were, you know, probably casted as such. We're not the most sex positive, pro sex people. And I think the casting was done to see that polarized positions. But yeah, so basically people come on that want sex therapy. And, you know, the funny joke I say to my clients often is, it would really help if I could be there in the room when it's happening, right? Because often I see my clients a week after the trouble's begun or they leave my office and they have to go home and figure things out. So yeah, I mean, it's bizarre in that they're having sex in a box, like, you know, a few hundred feet away from us, but it helps us to really be in the moment with them.
Yeah.
So we're there pre-sex and post-sex and we can really kind of get in there, right when it's still active and alive, which, believe me, I'm, it's not lost on me how wild that concept is.
It's wild, but it makes such sense.
Right? Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I've spooned with somebody after having sex and had like amazing conversations. Sure. And what if we had a therapist right there at the foot of the bed?
You just nailed it though. There's something powerful that does happen post sex mm-hmm. where you're at your most honest and bonded. I mean, think about sex for a minute, you know, eye contact, talk, touch, full body. You can't get closer to someone than you can if you have sex in those ways.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you can have very non-intimate distal sex, but if you choose to use it as a way to get really close and intimate, you can't get much closer.
So follow-up questions.
Yes.
What constituted having sex in that box? I just have to know.
Yeah.
Like, did everyone have to orgasm? Mm. Was it like, yeah?
No. I'm just nodding because it's a really smart question. So basically everyone that came on had a different struggle. You know, they would have used the word disorder. I don't use that word. I use the word struggle because there's no ordered way to have sex. So mm-hmm. you can't be sexually disordered. Mm-hmm. Sex is diverse. So basically they came on with different concerns or issues. Some of them were things like, I've never had sex with a third partner mm-hmm. or I've never had sex just be about me. It's a multitude of things. Yep. So it was kind of what it was for them. You did not have to orgasm. You didn't have to do anything if you didn't want to. There was some couples where we said, we think it would actually be, the big word is contraindicated, but it wouldn't be in service of anything healthy if you had sex. So we don't think you should at all. And we think you should go in there and just talk, or you guys actually need to just practice holding each other. Just go in there and cuddle because you use sex as a way to actually not be close. Mm-hmm. So practice just cuddling and talking. So there's a lot of things happening in there.
Who cleaned the box after?
Oh my gosh. Right. There was a PA and his job was solely to clean that box and believe that he had gloves and disinfectant and, yeah. And the kicker was you could tell who had sex and who didn't because you could smell it.
Oh, really?
You could smell the sex in the box. Oh, yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can always smell sex on someone who didn't have sex. Like when people get really turned on, but then don't actually have sex, then they like reek of sex. I love that.
That's phenomenal. And then what do you do? Are you like a heat seeking missile where you go in, you're like, this is my moment?
Usually it's like if we made out before going to dinner or something, and then I'd be like, whoa.
I smell sex on you that we didn't have yet.
That moment when someone's smell changes.
Yeah.
I love that moment.
It's a beautiful transition.
Mm, yeah. It's good times. Oh, Dr. Chris. Chris Donahue. What do you prefer people to call you?
I don't know. I get asked that sometimes. I don't know. Dr. Chris, Dr. Donahue, Chris. It doesn't matter.
Dr. Donahue sounds good.
You do? Okay, you like that? All right, we'll go with that.
That's good. I would be Dr. Doherty.
That's good too.
Is it?
Yeah.
Dr. Doherty sounds like a pretend person. There's actually a Sandra Doherty who is a cardiothoracic surgeon or something.
Do you get confused for her?
Absolutely not.
Have you ever like taken it on and done surgeries? Just make a little extra cash.
Only an improv class.
Do you take improv class?
I do. To work with that touch of autism I joked about earlier.
That's too scary for me. But good for you. Learn those relational skills.
Thanks. It's because I would be asked on to news programs and things and go blank because I didn't know how to be in the moment.
I'm floored by that because the couple times, I mean, I've seen you out in the world. We've been at lecture or something and then I've been on your show or whatever. Mm-hmm. I that blows my mind because you've always been very engaged and aware and thoughtful. I don't see it, but huh.
Thank you. Yeah. It's easier when I'm hosting.
Well done. Oh, is that what?
If I'm not hosting.
That's the difference then.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's control.
I get it. Trust me, I get it.
Oh, man. Okay, so what are we talking about? Sex Outside the Lines. And you're working on a second book.
I am. So this first book, Sex Outside the Lines, 3.5 years I've been working on it, and it's basically working to challenge norms that psychology and media have perpetuated as what's healthy and what your vision should be relationally and sexually. So it's challenging that because I think the norms that we're raised within and that psychology will perpetuate are actually unhealthy. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned in the book, we're at our highest rate of cheating, singledom, and divorce. It's not working. And let's stop blaming the people because that's what we're doing. Oh, let's do marital therapy. Something's wrong with you because you can't manage your therapy. Oh, no. It's because marriage isn't working the way we're doing it. Marriage is the problem, right? Mm-hmm. That's the problem is marriage. We don't have a marriage crisis. Marriage is the crisis.
Do you think it's the way we do marriage,
yes,
or do you think it's marriage, the idea?
It's both. And we talked a little bit about this a while back on the monogamy podcast, but monogamy's awesome. Congratulations, do it. You'll learn a lot, but it's not natural. It's not easy. It's an odd configuration. I don't recommend it for everyone. And, you know, now that we're living longer and longer, to expect marital bliss or monogamy for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years is crazy. And I did a blog and it was titled Cheating, an expected stage of every relationship.
Whoa. What? Wait, in every expected stage?
An expected stage in every relationship.
Oh, as the colon rest of the title.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes.
That's a stage of a relationship.
Every relationship, yes, cheating. Sit with that for a minute.
That's intense.
Yes.
And that's telling someone who's been with someone 20 years that they probably got cheated on at some
point. Likely, yeah. 75% probably, yeah.
I don't know why I'm like my narrowing eyes at you. Like
it scares
I don't
people.
Like the way you're saying. Yeah, I feel challenged by that.
Yeah, and yet we shouldn't. You know, when I run some of my groups or I lecture a lot at universities and all around the country for expos, conferences, and if I throw that out there, people panic, or they'll reference, you know, cheating as a reason to leave a relationship, and I always say absolutely not. You do not leave or break up with someone over cheating. Cheating should be expected. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it feels good. I'm not saying attempt to do it. I'm not saying allow it. I'm not giving permission for it. But I'm saying that when it happens, it's a symptom of a lot of different things. And the work mm-hmm. is about either, the work is about discussing that. Is it because monogamy is hard for you? Is it because our sex life isn't existent or what you're looking for? Is it because we've been together for a long time and we don't prioritize each other? How can we use this experience to learn about ourselves and our relationship? Mm-hmm. But it's not a flaw. It's somewhat expected. Huh. But it shouldn't be bad because it doesn't speak to necessarily a lack of care or love. Look, of all the options, it's a horrible one to choose. I'd rather people sit down and say, hey, this isn't working, or I need to ask for something different and not act it out via cheating. But yeah, monogamy and commitment are difficult. Yeah.
But it's expected. It's sure. going to happen. Yep. Probably. Deal with it. Now I'm looking at the title of your book and it says Authentic Sexuality in a Sexually Dysfunctional Culture. Now.
That's a mouthful.
On the Sexbox website.
Uh-oh.
Your bio. It was like your little blurb and you're very happy. Like you're crossing your arms and being like, I'm a therapist. I have tattoos, you know.
Yes.
Like he's
yes.
cute and tough.
Oh, that's my branding. Yes.
But it said like that. I like short bios because it really cuts to the heart of someone. And it was like, you want for people to have great sex lives. Like, yes. That's what you want.
Yes.
And then in this book, I'm seeing authentic sexuality. Yes. And as a therapist, you wish that you could be with people right after they had sex. Like, did you find that on Sexbox that you were able to get to people's authentic selves more after they were close
to? That's a good question. yes. Well, I'll say this. I think our authenticity lies most in our sexuality because of all that's pulled in there. So let me just start there that like your sexuality and your sex is your self-esteem, your body esteem. Mm-hmm. It's an accumulation of the experiences you've had with others in the world. So just your level of value in general, your ability and tolerance for intimacy and closeness, your communication skills, boundaries, all of your social family traumas in there. I mean, in our sex lives is everything. So I think authenticity can best be built from within there. Where a lot of therapists and people think, oh, work on your career, work on all these other elements, and sex is pushed aside as some extraneous component. It's like, no, let's do all that work through and via sex. Let's actually use sex as therapy, which is what sex therapists do not do. They do therapy on sex. They don't use sex therapeutically. And I try to have people have sex in ways that are therapeutic. Like, oh, you don't feel good about yourself? Have some sex. Mm-hmm. Let yourself see other people be aroused by the body you have to get some body esteem. That is one of the most brilliant ways to get some body esteem is to have a lot of sex. You want to learn tolerance and intimacy tolerance? Go fuck. You want to learn communication skills? Date. You were talking earlier about dating multitude of people. Mm-hmm. That is brilliant. I want people dating as many people as they can and learning all these different experiences and learning about themselves. So that's what the book is trying to do. It's normalizing the complexity and diversity that authentic sexuality tends to be, but our culture has shamed a lot of it. And so a lot of us have kind of compartmentalized or pushed away things that we're interested in. And that's a denial of our totality. And you can't feel okay about yourself when you're doing that.
Can't.
No way.
No.
I mean, imagine if you had to ignore massive components of things that were like pleasurable for you or things you wanted sexually, you then can't feel okay hiding that.
Well, if I didn't know, like, as long as I protected myself and didn't like give in to temptation, I wouldn't know any better. And so it's fine.
Yep. Yep. What? Avoid sex?
Well, you know, like only with my partner that I only had sex with after marriage. And like, you know, we don't know any better because it's just us together.
But I think you do. I think you do. I think that's a lie, right? Because I think we live in a planet where you're going to encounter billboards and things on television. And I think you can't live in that state of denial, mm-hmm. you know, like not knowing. I think you do know. And that's why I think waiting to have sex until marriage is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. Because the idea is if I love you enough, sex will just work.
What if they wait till marriage, then after like a year or two, they open up and they have wild sex with everyone?
I think it's phenomenal.
I was just throwing out there like that would be a neat model. Like you can't have sex until marriage, but once you get married, you two can have
Game
sex
on.
With as many people as you
Game
want.
Game on. Sure. That'd I mean, I would love that, but that is, you know, the inverse of what's mandated. So don't hold your breath for that model.
It'd be fun. It'd be like sex would become a team sport.
Yeah.
You know, culturally.
Oh, let me tell you something. There is, I myself, having had sex with other couples, there's something really powerfully beautiful and arousing to watch a partner, watch their partner be sexual with someone else. Mm-hmm. To see the love and care and enjoyment of watching their partner drive pleasure and joy in the moment in front of them is mind blowing.
It's pretty hot. Jada Pinkett Smith on one of the late night shows was talking about watching Will Smith in sex scenes and that she loves it because she can see him.
Yeah.
Is that what he looks like?
Yeah. And talk about seeing someone in their most honest, vulnerable state. Mm-hmm. And also just learn parts about them that they maybe don't or can't express with you. And so you learn that your partner, you learn that you don't own your partner. Mm-hmm. And you learn that you can't be everything to your partner. And I've dated my most recent partner that I dated was in the adult film industry. And two partners back, I dated someone who was an active sex worker escort and also porn actor. Mm-hmm. And so I got to see both of them in a multitude of their films. And part of my sex life was watching their films. Mm-hmm. And every now and then there's a little anxiety, but there's something really arousing about watching them be with other people, for sure.
But what about the people who don't find that arousing? And what about the people who, when they hear that, it sounds like sexuality is a freeway. Like I've always thought of, for me, sex is like when you're drilling down to the core of the earth, like I can just get to the depths of my soul through.
That's amazing.
Thank you. Like that's just how I can heal a lot of myself is through my sexuality. However, what about people who just don't have that kind of relationship with themselves? Like they just like, oh, that doesn't resonate for me. Like
yeah.
sex just feels good. And
I think it won't resonate for most people. And I think that's because most people haven't been given the opportunity to possibly see sex in the way that you just spoke about. Like you weren't born that way. You weren't socialized to see it that way. You've gotten yourself there because of the work you do and the people you're around and your interests. Most of us are not born valuing sex as in a way to have insight into ourselves or to drill to our core, right? Oh. And most of us are trained to have things like jealousy. Jealousy in my mind is a social emotion. It doesn't exist, socially created. And if we start to see relationship and sex as something that we don't have ownership over with our partners, and we were raised in models where we were comfortable with our partner dating other people or open relationships, we wouldn't have jealousy. But very few people in your life will say, hey, sex is a way to get to learn about yourself or your partner. It's not usually how it's framed. Mm-hmm. Even again, with sex therapists, a lot of them do sex again on they do therapy on your sex life. They don't use sex as a way to learn about you or to help you learn about yourself.
It's not a tool.
It's not a tool.
It's a thing to treat.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like a renegade sex therapist.
Yeah, it probably turns out to be that way. I mean, it's a funky thing to see it that way because I think what I'm doing makes so much sense. And I think it's actually really radical what everyone else is doing. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's really radical that a marital therapist will only talk about monogamy as the only option for intimacy and closeness. That to me is bizarrely radical. I think it's actually not that radical for me to say, hey, there's a multitude of ways to be with your partner, mm-hmm. non-monogamy, open, polyamory, like all these different things. But yeah, I probably am. And a lot of my work, like my next book and the conferences I present at are challenging and calling bullshit on a lot of psychology and therapists. And the book, one of the chapters is calling bullshit on therapists saying, stop being sexual fascists. Mm-hmm. Stop trying to control and normalize people's sexuality. You're mm-hmm. traumatizing them.
Yeah. My therapist is, she's great. Like she's open-minded and okay. She doesn't know about a lot of stuff. Like I don't really talk about my sexuality that much because it's like,
see, that
it's
blows
fine.
My mind.
Oh, really?
Because it's a missing piece. I think your sex is fine, but that still leaves out the discussion of sex as a way to learn more about some of your other struggles as an entry point. Like if you're having relational issues, sex can often be talked about as a resolve for things like that, but we usually don't go into that.
Right. Like she's not trained to analyze the greater bits of myself from how I'm relating to my sexuality. Right. Like that's not how she enters my issues at all.
Right.
I mean, I think about that on my own time. But it's good that when I do mention stuff like poly stuff, she does ask me and make sure that I'm okay. But it's like, she's checked in enough times. Like,
what do you mean when you say she asks you to make sure you're
like,
okay?
Like, she wants to clarify, like if I say like, oh, my, I don't talk about a lot of my personal stuff on the show, but it's like, oh, I was with this woman. And then like in the next breath talk about, you know, my partner and then she'll relate it to something else I was saying earlier about anxiety or whatever and be like, I'm just checking. But in this scenario, is that stressing because of that other thing? Like she's like, oh,
okay. Yeah, that's
good.
And
I'll be like, no.
Okay,
no,
that's
this
good.
Is totally healthy and fine. It's the other things.
I was afraid. I thought you were saying she wanted to investigate your diverse relational system or style as possibly not a healthy thing for you versus... Because, and that's, you know, like if you go into a couples therapy and you say, you know, this is my husband, we're married. They'll never say, oh, well, let's talk about the downsides to that and whether or not that decision was made from your health. Mm-hmm. They'll assume that that's a healthy move. That's odd. But if you go in saying you're open, they'll want to talk about that and whether or not that was a good move. Why aren't we talking about whether or not monogamy and marriage is a good move or why did you choose that? Or they'll never attack it from that perspective.
Oh. That is so clear and excellent. I was like, oh yeah, totes. Oh, yeah. No, she's skimming around. Like I can tell that she's challenged, but she's doing it well. But it still entertains me a little bit when she does check in. I'm like, no, it's good.
Yeah, she's learning from you. That's good though. It's not a bad thing.
Hey, I talked about I was kind of realizing that I was agender, and I was like, do you need me to clarify? She's like, no, I know what that is. And I was like, oh.
I love that she knows what it is, and I hope that she was able to accept that and not find anything problematic in that. I'll tell you, I think health is in being agender. I think I want to make sure I'm saying this correctly. I think health is being not a gender, but a gender. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yes,
I feel like you have to write it out to show the distinction between those two. Because I think to be gendered is unhealthy. I think to say like, hey, I was diagnosed as a boy and I was born with a penis and all the expectations on me as being a male, that makes sense. I sign up for that. There's a lot of flaws in that. I think everyone should rebel against their gendered expectations and all that. And I talk about this in the book. I think health lies in transgenderism. I think, you know, gender identity disorder is cisgendered, is assuming that your gender diagnostics as you were born is okay. That's disordered in my mind. Mm-hmm. I think it's really healthy for you to say, I'm not that gender. I'm no gender. I'm multigendered, because that makes more sense based on the diversity that all of us are.
So does that mean if someone's listening and they feel cis, they just feel like a man, they just feel like a woman, it's no big deal. Oh, you made a face.
That's more problematic for me than someone to say, I don't feel like the gender that was given to me or I was born with.
Interesting. Because they're signing up for so many things.
They're signing up for so many things. They're going to be limited. Sexism lives in all of that. And sexism and gender is so violent and oppressive and leads to so many problems, social, macro, psycho problems. It's endless.
It sounds like it's not that you have issues with somebody being like, oh, I feel like a man. It's that there are so many asterisks that come up in life. Yes. And the institution of gender.
Yes. I think the most... healthy way to parent is gender neutral parenting, where you don't put any restrictions or impositions on your child based on their, you know, genitalia at birth, and that instead you just allow them to have options that are quote unquote traditionally assigned with either gender, and let them make sense of what they want and play with what they want and dress how they want and find their own way in the world.
Boys can cry and girls can play with G.I. Joe.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the basis of it. But yeah, a lot of people won't even allow that. Yeah.
Oh, I was not allowed. I mean, I wanted so many boys' toys as a kid, and I wanted a power drill. I still bring it up with my parents. They're like, "Ah, we were trying the best we could." I'm like, "I really wanted."
Isn't that interesting though that they were afraid to let you have a power drill? What was going to become of you if they had given you that? What
was
their
fear? I might have made something.
Yeah, good call. I might have built a bookshelf.
But they gave my younger brother one. That's what bothered me.
Yeah, I know, because they had no fear of giving him one. It's just so interesting how arbitrary it is. Children's toys and colors, you know.
Yeah.
But it's funny, you know, like I'm that guy that when I go to like a health clinic or somewhere and I get their intake forms and there's only two gender options. I'm sitting down with the office manager saying, I got to let you know how offensive and oppressive that is. And if a client comes in here and can't check male or female, you're giving them a strong message about how welcome they are here. And I'll say to them, I don't want to check male. I don't like the implications of me checking that. And I don't like the idea that if I check that, you feel like you know me or you learned something about me. You haven't learned anything, maybe some stereotypes, and most of them don't even hold, which is why I don't subscribe to any sexual orientation. If I tell you I'm gay or straight, you're going to make a lot of stereotypical assumptions and they probably will not hold either of them. Mm-hmm. Bam.
Whoa. Wait a minute. Okay. So I can, I mean, we talked about flagging earlier and so it's like, okay, you have tattoos and bicep muscles that tell me that you go to the gym. So you probably, I can assume that you drink overpriced juice sometimes.
That's actually really funny. The key word would be sometimes. It's rare. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So many things. I'm not necessarily thinking about what I assume about you or what you assume about me.
Right.
I feel like, is it bad to assume things? It feels like if we can't assume anything, then we're just having a really intense conversation with people constantly.
Yeah. I mean, it goes both ways. Like, I think there's a beauty in not being able to assume and having to ask, because then you actually learn about them. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you. We need context. We need some kind of frame of reference. We need some way to kind of place you in the world. But then we have to also recognize that there's a lot of problems in doing so. Mm-hmm. It's both.
Yeah.
But I don't mind. Like, I love the notion that if I'm out and someone wants to have sex with me or date me, that they have to come up to me and say, well, here's an example. I was at a bar, which is rare. I don't enjoy that social world, but I was at a bar and I was standing outside in the lobby and there was a girl there that was selling posters and books because it was some event. And she was like looking at me and I was watching her watch me and I couldn't quite figure out what her thought bubble was, like what she was trying to figure out. Cause she wasn't flirting per se, but she wasn't not flirting. And she finally came over and I loved how bold she was. And she said, I would love to have sex with you. I just don't know if you're open to having sex with women. I loved that she was able to be that confident in the sex piece.
Wow.
Yes. Yes. My mind was blown by that. And number two, that she was willing to ask.
Did you get her number?
I don't know what she like.
I think
that's a whole nother
story. I'm asking because I want to like have a conversation with her. Like, tell me everything.
I mean, I guess the context of this is it was a night at a bar in Silver Lake and it was a queer event. Mm. And so it was people that were more sex positive and more sophisticated and understood that people had more of a fluidity. So that allows her to maybe say that in that way. But I hope she lives that way in the world always. But I like people asking me that because I don't want someone to assume.
I preferably not.
But what would you do if someone came up to you and said, I'd love to have sex with you? Wouldn't that blow your mind?
Well,
because it doesn't happen.
I definitely experience a certain amount of physical, like I want to make sure that I feel physically safe. So if someone's saying it in a friendly way and they blink when they say it, right? And there's that like non-threatening feeling I get from them.
Yeah.
And that their ego doesn't depend on me saying yes or no.
For sure.
That would be awesome.
Well said. Yeah. I had no fear of violence or I was not intimidated. I wasn't going to be. I'm a lot larger than this girl. So I agree with you.
Right. And I tend to be codependent where I want to make sure everyone's feelings are being taken care of before my own.
Uh-oh.
So that can be difficult when it comes to rejecting people.
Of course. Yeah. And I'm glad you bring that in. That's in there. Safety, rape culture, like that's all in there. Gendered norms. But I guess we can't put all that aside, but if we could, I just love the notion that someone could walk up and say, hey, I think you're attractive. I was admiring you. I'd love to be sexual with you.
Yeah. That's super hot.
Right. It's fascinating.
I love if someone asks if they can kiss me.
Yeah, you do. So some people don't like that.
Exactly. And I think it's the same thing is it throws people off. Like if I, right, you love, that people don't assume anything.
Right.
But it's challenging and it feels unsafe because it's like, I never know. And it's just like,
I know. It denies the truth, which is that sex is very fluid and that if you allow it to change and grow and evolve, it does. And that it's not just what it is. And that every time I have sex with a different person, it's different. So I love the notion that you're always a virgin when you're with a new partner, even the same partner, right? Because I don't know who I'm going to be with you. And I think good sex is about diversity. And so I'm not going to try to do it or embody it the same way with every person, right? We're going to create something new and different.
That's true. You're a different lover with each person.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Absolutely. And so, and it's going to change based on who's asking. If a guy and a girl approach me and they're like, hey, we'd love for you to have sex with us, sometimes that's going to make a lot of sense to me. And so in that way, call me bisexual in that moment. If I'm going to go home and enjoy watching them together and engage in both, I could be approached by two women and depending on what's on the table, or two men. So I like that space to learn and grow, because I'll tell you, my sexuality now is far more sophisticated than it was many years ago, because I've made myself be open to certain things. And I've used sex as a way to learn to challenge racism and sexism and homophobia. I mean, what races won't you have sex with? That's a bizarre statement. You can knock off an entire race. I mean, it's fascinating. People see their sexuality as fluid. You'll see that. I don't have sex with this culture. That, I mean, really?
Okay.
It's kind of like when I said I love all Australians and you were like, oh, every single one of them. And I was like, thank you. Well said. You're right.
Well, thank you. However, what about the conversation? Because I interviewed an African-American sex educator about this issue around OkCupid, and that African-American women don't get hardly any play on there. And she was like, well, it's also that if you're wanting to date specific type of people, you go to a different dating site, and so their date is a bit skewed. And like,
But OkCupid's a white person site? Is that the implication, and that you should only expect that? Because that's horrible.
Right. I feel challenged on multiple levels. I guess my point is, should we fault people for getting turned on by a certain cues and not others?
It's twofold. And this is an important question. So the first answer is no. You're allowed to honor what you're aroused by. So start there for a second. So I would never say to someone right off the bat, have sex with things that you're not turned on by. What I would say, the second step is that most likely though, there's a lot of arousal to be had for things that you're not considering. And so I would say, try to maybe have sex in a way that accounts for the possibility. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a larger issue that right now we have a lot of systemic and institutional racism that runs rampant for sure. And we have to attack it. And until racism is dealt with and it has a trickle down effect into our sexuality, you're not going to be able to have much movement out of that. So it's both. We have to fight racism, because your sexuality has internalized some of that. Mm-hmm. But until we get there and we've eroticized all races and there's equality in that, you are going to be limited by what you're turned on by. So I think honor what you're aroused by while also fighting the bigger issue that you're a victim to. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's both.
Well said again.
But that's why I think there's a big social justice component that is missing in psychology and sex therapy. Have sex with who you like while recognizing that's based on sexism, homophobia, and racism in our culture, and work on changing that too.
Wow. Yeah, I've been thinking about racism a lot lately, as many people have been, right, especially with all of the shootings and issues and activism and conversations. And the one thing that I have not seen is people admitting that they're racist.
Yeah. And that was huge for me. I had to go through a period where I had to examine my racism, and my sexism and all the isms, and realize that like I am a classist as well. And, and really looking at, ways to, first you have to acknowledge it to then be able to dismantle it. Mm-hmm. And if you can't acknowledge it, you can't work against it. Mm-hmm. And anyone that's thinking like, I'm not racist, I'm horrified, 'cause you are, that's just how our culture is. And so it was hard for me, because I want to believe as a person who's in social justice or as a therapist that I'm like better than all of that. And I had to realize, no, and I had to look at the ways that I'm perpetuating it. And there was a time that it was a little depressive, to see all of that and see ways that I occupy white privilege and thin privilege because I'm in shape and things like that. So yeah, you have to be able to acknowledge it. It's scary.
It is scary.
It's sad.
It is, but admitting it is the first step.
For sure.
Good job.
Thanks.
but I'm not racist. I've been embracing a lot of it. Like just a lot of it.
You can't not. And that's why I'm brokenhearted by all of the shootings, what's going on. But the beauty of it is maybe because of the concentration of it, we're going to wake up a little bit. But again, looking at it through sex, like I want anyone listening to make a list in their head of what immediate non-starters exist for them in terms of race around sex. And then to say, how can I rule out entire race off the bat? Mm-hmm. And then maybe actually try to use your sexuality as a way to work through that, have sex with races that you normally wouldn't allow yourself to, and realize that, that it's not a real construct that you're mm-hmm. using to kind of block them out. Mm-hmm. I love that idea. I've had to do that. Learn to eroticize things that you can't or haven't.
You know what I think would be a helpful tool? Because so much of it, it seems, is from just the basics of the effect of pop culture and shows and movies on the stories we tell ourselves and what we understand. Who are the romantic leads? Mainly white people. Mm-hmm. Is what if we like totally marathoned a bunch of like shows and movies where Asian people and African-American people and Mexican people and all sorts of people are the leads, except for telenovelas, because they're crazy.
As long as we don't market it as an Afrocentric or Asian-centric show, it has to just happen to have them as the lead.
Right, like Rhonda, right? Rhonda Shine. Yeah. Wait, no, Shonda Rhimes.
Yeah, it's tough to get that one out.
Yeah.
No, but that's a, yeah, for sure, where this isn't a black show or a white show. It's a show and there's people on it and some of them happen to be gay and they're not a gay character. They're a character that happens to have gay sex. Yeah.
Right. Like, I was just reading, telling universal stories and not make, like, why are we telling universal stories with just white people?
Favorite story of mine. I don't know if you remember this or even heard about this, but a year ago, 2 years ago, there was a documentary that was done on this gay couple, and Oprah's network aired it on this gay couple that was getting married. And I think one of the guys, it was two men, one of the guys' families was not supportive of it. And my mom called me and she was like, isn't that great? Oprah herself. And it's this documentary about this gay couple and they're getting married. And like, that's such a big step. And I was like, they're both two skinny, white, wealthy, attractive men. I'm not blown away. I am not impressed. If they were fat, multicultural, maybe black, Latino, low class, unattractive, and they put that on the air and we all watched it, then I'm blown away. And until I see that in a paper towel commercial, I'm not impressed. It's like when Ellen Page came out as a lesbian at the HRC or something. I was bored. Wealthy white girl comes out as gay. There's no risk in that. She has millions. She's not losing family. She's not losing her career. She's probably going to make more films. It's like they're not the real warriors. You know, Caitlyn Jenner coming out. That is awesome. Congratulations. So brave. Vanity Fair, well done. But that's not the warriors that blow my mind. It's the kids that lose their family and their jobs and minorities that are coming out and it's a real risk and don't get a TV show on E.
Well,
it's both, right?
I 70% disagree.
Oh, 70%.
Math.
Jump in.
Because while the people who are struggling
yes.
and brave to come out and suffer, that's all important to acknowledge. It's people using their wealth and fame and privilege to come out and stand with their groups that are marginalized. I think that
it's a beautiful move. And that's why I do congratulate like Vanity Fair for putting her on the cover like that. I mean, that's phenomenal. We've all seen who's on the cover. Traditionally, it's probably usually females, probably usually white, always cisgendered. So that's awesome. And I don't want to take away from that. And it's not take away from Caitlyn. Like that's very, very brave. And that's all in there. But it's kind of like, I remember one of my best friends said this when Ellen Page came out, or Ellen, he was like, that's awesome. But I came out when it was a real struggle in the '80s. Like you're late. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is it's called being late to the party.
Right.
So not to take away from anyone's experience or journey. And I'm not saying if it's not rough, that it's not valuable, meaningful. It is. And like you're saying, for them to take their big play, that's kind of what I do, where I've gotten a lot of pushback where people will say, you're not trans and you're white and you have thin privilege and male privilege and white privilege. And I'm like, you're right. And the only defense I have is, because in my book, you'll see a lot of like queer feminist based thought and theory. I'll say, I'm trying to use a platform that I have to create change. And like, that's necessary. And so people could say the same thing I'm saying about Caitlyn to me. Mm-hmm. And I agree. So it's both, you know?
It's both. So you disagree with yourself a little bit.
I think it's both and all and neither, you know?
Ugh. I would so hate to see you in a court of law. You'd be such a pain in the ass lawyer.
I would be. That's not what I said, but it is what I said, but not exactly what I said.
Oh my goodness. Or politician.
Ooh. Yeah, I'd be good in politics.
Let's break it down.
Yeah.
Right now, because I do want to talk with you more in future episodes. Mm-hmm. Now that I know that I don't have to drive too far.
Yeah,
no,
right?
You're great. Nice and I enjoy talking with you.
Thanks.
If someone's listening to this, secretly myself, and I would like to have more authentic sexuality.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Well, the first step is read my book. Sex Outside Lines. And I'll tell you why. Because it's a journey, and each chapter essentially works to slowly dismantle all the ideas you have about what's right, acceptable, appropriate, or healthy sexually. And it really works to start to normalize and show the health in diverse, creative ways of being relationally and sexually. And the message of the book is normal is not the goal. Stop trying to be normal.
So this is like the artist's way, but for your sexuality.
I suppose so, yeah. Normal is not the goal. The goal is not being normal. The goal is to be diverse and abnormal, and there's health in nonconformity and outside the lines, and that's what your work should be about. So that's the easiest answer is read the book. Really pay attention to what challenges you and zero in on that. Why am I so uncomfortable with this idea? Because that's where your work and growth is. It's not about just agreeing and agreeing and agreeing. And learn to value sex and have sex. I think that's another important thing. And that's in the book as well. You know, have sex. Learn to value sex. Learn to grow through sex. Learn to prioritize sex.
Even if it's just with yourself?
Especially if it's just with yourself.
Okay. Some people get real bummed out. Like, oh, I don't have a partner. It's like, oh, you know how much kinky sex you can have with yourself?
For sure. And man, if yourself heard yourself say that, they would be very upset with you. You know what I mean? Like, experiences on our own are very valuable experiences. You know, to do something on your own is not to have it have to be a lesser experience. And I try to talk about that with couples, that there's partnered sex and solo sex, mm-hmm. both important, both valid, both legitimate, neither prioritized.
Both part of a well-balanced meal.
Yeah. Singledom's going to happen too. You're not always going to have a partner mm-hmm. or a relationship.
Absolutely. I'm looking at the chapters, Liberate Sex and Get Naked, Chapter 1. Chapter 2, Why We're Scared of Sex. That, like, everybody needs to read that. But Chapter 3, Sex Education is Dangerous. Chris.
But you're on board with this. I think you'd agree that the standard model of sex education is not bad. It's dangerous. Because it's not going to, and I'm not saying we don't need sex education. Don't do it. I'm saying we need it. We need it done differently, though.
Okay, fine. I feel like you just need to write in on every book so that people see that.
But that's why you have to read the book, because it explains.
Right.
It explains.
Absolutely.
It's the way we're doing it.
What was the most challenging chapter?
Probably the identity chapter.
Yeah?
Yeah, because it was quite complex, and you're literally reading me working through it and trying to figure it out and mm-hmm. make sense of it, and there's a lot in there. And, you know, the one caveat I give to all this is where my work's at now, and there's something very vulnerable in publishing a book that's like this, because you're kind of seeing, if you really do a characterological study on it, you're learning a lot about who I am and what my work is. But my second book could possibly say the opposite of everything in this book, because I'm changing, growing, my ideas are evolving.
It's like me. Every time I try and write anything, I go, 10 minutes ago, I was different. Oh.
Yes. And that's scary. There was a time when my editor was like, stop sending me stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, this book doesn't have to encapsulate everything. It's not capital T truth. It's a picture of where you're at right now, and you're allowed to evolve. And so the second book will be what it is. I mean, there's a lot of congruence for sure, but there's some things that are going to change and move a little bit, because I'm different based on what's going on in my life and who I'm with mm-hmm. and what's happening. Yeah, for sure.
Faux
show. Faux show.
No identity, gender, or sexual orientation.
Yeah, that scared some people when I presented that at a conference at UCLA recently. A couple of people were really thrown off by that. It was scary for them. But, you know, younger generations, got to look at them to see what's going on. The younger generations are like, dude, I'm not a guy. I'm not a girl. I don't know. I don't care. I'm not gay. I'm not straight. I haven't figured it out yet. Doing what I'm doing, making out with both. I'll let you know. Maybe I won't. That's where we're headed.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of teenagers now have a lot less baggage than
it's a beautiful thing. Beautiful
generation.
Thing. When I was in high school and I was dating like men and women and having sex with both, I couldn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. People would not have understood that. It would have called me a fag or something, you know, just zeroing in on, well, if a dude's with a dude, that means you're gay. But if a dude's always with dudes and has sex with a woman one time, that doesn't make him straight. It's like this odd, you know, mm-hmm. But now, you know, my niece, she's 16. I talk about her all the time. I learn a lot from her. She's doing what she wants, when she wants, how she wants, and she's not feeling pegged. And her friends at school don't care. It's awesome.
You might need to be more considerate about how you use the word pegged.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It's a fun sex act, and it's not a bad thing to be pegged. It's a good thing. We should all get pegged. Men need to get more comfortable with pegging.
Yes.
It's phenomenal. It's such a, I mean, let's talk about that for a second though. As you do sex education, I saw you tweet, you're tweeting about anal.
Probably. Anal. It's anal August.
Yes, that's what it was. And you were like, you don't have to do it in the butt, but become more aware of the butt. Wasn't mm-hmm. that what you said? Yeah. Like it's so reductive and limiting for men to shrink sexuality for themselves to these small locations geographically. Like mm-hmm. you've got a lot of body. It's not just mm-hmm. about the dick, you know?
Yep. We're sexual from the top of our heads to the bottom of our feet, everywhere.
Atta girl.
Ooh. I say that kind of stuff in class. People seem to like it then. What was I going to say? Here's a question. Do you have any tips for, because you did mention that, you know, being a cis-seeming white male.
Oh, you keep coining these new terms. Cis-seeming, that is one of the, that and financial terrorism. Those are the two takeaways. All right. So as a cis-seamer.
And I have gotten this question and I've given answers to this, but I feel like you might be able to help me out here. What do I tell someone that asks me like, hey, Sandra, I'm a white straight male who's exploring his sexuality. I feel really sex positive. I want to go to parties. I want to maybe break out of boxes that I'm not even sure if I'm in yet, but I feel like there's no place for me in the conversation because I'm the man. Do the white straight boys need to just be quiet for the next 10 years, or can they too grow and change?
It's both. It's kind of both. Oh man. It's both. I think in a way it's tough because when you're occupying, as you just painted that person, every possible level of privilege that we can kind of come up with, you do have to be quiet in one way, but I don't want to take away space for them to learn and grow and evolve and try out other things and maybe realize that they're not as straight or as cis as they thought they were. God, it's a complex question.
It is.
But I would say go in there acknowledging your privilege and own it mm-hmm. and recognize it. That's the first step. Allow space and voice for minorities to occupy it because you're used to occupying all of it. But also be receptive and reactive and engage mm-hmm. and allow yourself to have a process too. Mm-hmm. Is that vague?
No, it's good. It's good. It's a tough conversation. I just was reminded that one privilege that I struggle with, especially in talking to people and, mm-hmm. and teaching workshops and things, is, and I get a lot of questions around dating, even though I'm really bad at it, is that, and it's weird to say this because I also have body image issues, but I mean, being a, you know, fairly classically attractive human person, mm-hmm. female, I don't have a hard time getting dates. So anyone who has had a lifetime of struggling with romance, I have such privilege in that arena. And I don't feel like I can even fully, like I should just be quiet and let them speak, you know, like I don't.
And you're accurate. 'Cause I'm in the same position where I'll have a client before me and I also don't traditionally have problems dating. Mm-hmm. If me and you wanted to have sex or get a date in the next hour, we most likely could pull that together.
Who do you think would get one faster?
You. I think it's very possible.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So I'm glad we're
on board with that. If we went west more.
But if we went all the way west, it's back to you again.
Right. I've been dancing at those meat markets. I know what's up.
Yeah.
But
you need to let them speak.
Okay.
Yeah, you do. Because I don't like the idea of you just got to get out there because you just have to get out there and that's all you need. Mm-hmm. But when you're battling systemic and institutional sexism, racism, ableism, where, you know, people that are disabled are perceived as not erotic and not legitimate and all that. Oh, it's very different. Absolutely. You know, levels of intersectionality where for sure it's going to be very problematic. Again, it's about the social justice component though, again, where let's do our sex therapy, let's do our sex ed, but let's also make sure we're working actively to do social justice work and on a macro level, trying to get rid of and call out the sexism, racism, homophobia, and all that we're seeing in the world that is trickling down and not allowing this person to be seen by other people in the way that they want to. Right? It's two processes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's why I'm always trying to do that, like in the world and in my book and in my office. I'm going to work with you, but I'm also going to work with the world because the world's working against you. Mm-hmm. And you can only do so much against the world.
You're working to help people individually, but then also like top down.
Absolutely.
Culturally wide.
Yeah. And psychology doesn't do that or look at it that way. And that's mm-hmm. the massive flaw. It just says something's wrong with you. So I'm going to work with you quietly in my office and ignore the top down trickle down effect that you're a victim to. A lot of therapy is victim blaming.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Total victim blaming. Something's wrong with your thought process. Really? Because I live in this fucking world that tells me that my body's not sexual or erotic, or because I'm a man, I have to do this and blah, blah, blah. And you're telling me it's my thought process and I need some cognitive behavioral therapy. You are ignoring the vast of what's happening for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot of anxiety around, well, I've just anxiety about a lot of things, but how I dress myself is really stressful around gender because mm-hmm. you're giving you're flagging no matter what you do. Like I can't, unless I wear a bed sheet, I'm yes. giving some sort of signaling. It's difficult. And so I Pinterest, like genderqueer fashion. Mm. But the problem is that they're all really skinny and that there's a specific androgynous type that models everything. So
women can wear traditional men's and women's clothing and still be seen as feminine and a girl. Women can wear pants and a tie, where if a man puts on a traditional female garb, like a dress, that's a different experience from a woman wearing like, what's men's clothing? Men's clothing doesn't really exist because men's clothing is women. You know, women can wear men's clothing.
Right. Unisex or women's. Those are the two clothing categories. Yeah, that's true. You got to work much harder.
But that's why I wear a lot of black. It's this like half-hearted, feeble attempt to not cooperate with some fashion social norms. When I go to the office or on television, I'm forced to play a role in a capacity. Television's going to make me wear jewel tones. They always say that. Wear jewel tones. It looks great on television. They do for men. It's horrible. But in my personal life, as you're seeing, I wear all black because I'm not going to cooperate with the fashion industry, mm-hmm. which is one of the most body-shaming, sexist, problematic things in the entire world. Like dress for your body, really? How about I wear whatever the fuck I want? You know, I hate when they say like, that's not right for your body type. Wow. That was offensive. How should my body be? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I'm a pear shape.
I'm a block. I'm a box. I'm literally shaped like a muscle box.
I guess you're a rectangle. You're an upside down triangle a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, it's nonetheless, I have other priorities. And so it's like throw on the black and go live my life, go kick some social justice butt.
Right. But then also you work out a lot.
I do. But also you're talking about getting flagged though. Me wearing all black is a whole social signifier. You know what I mean? Like that gives off a message that works for me and against me as well.
Yeah.
Because we live in like a beach community. LA. People are wearing.
Oh, I hate the beach and can't swim.
But I mean, even yes. LA, everyone's wearing like, lemon colored shorts that are men or women and whatnot. And I'm wearing black in the 90 degree weather in LA.
So you're already seeming to come off as like a rebel.
I don't know. As something. Yeah. I don't know if it's always positive, but.
I have distressed leather, like studded boots. And so I flag for being ready for the apocalypse
versus in your heels and whatnot being ready to party.
I've sworn off heels for the rest of my life.
Probably a smart move for your legs. Yeah.
I hurt myself a lot.
I could imagine.
Yeah. It's dangerous. Heels are dangerous.
It really is.
You know, I'm wear them. I am open to you wearing them.
Yeah. I don't see that happening.
Don't box yourself in. Have an authentic sexuality.
I look at them and I think there's nothing comfortable about what I'm looking at.
No.
Sneakers.
But it makes your ass look great.
Yeah? All right.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
It's good. It's good for posture.
It's good. All right.
Dr. Chris Donahue, where can people find you out in the world?
Okay. So I guess my website, drchrisdonahue.com.
Donahue.
Yeah. Donahue. It's a fun spelling. Or my Twitter is @ChrisDonahue. Or my Instagram is @DrDonahue.
Okay. And you practice in Beverly Hills?
I just moved my office to Larchmont.
Okay, so a little bit more east.
Yeah, so great. I'm so happy. Yeah, a little more east. Shift. I love the environment over there. Awesome coffee shops. I'm a big coffee shop guy. Phenomenal coffee shops over there.
Do you do any coaching or therapy over Skype?
It's funky. You know, I'm licensed in the state of California, so I can do coaching and education via Skype. When my schedule allows, I'm pretty busy. I do a lot of, you know, traveling to present at conferences or universities. So, hey, if you want me to come speak at your university, have someone reach out and invite me. I love coming and talking to universities and students or your organization. If you can't get to LA, yeah, have me come out.
Cool. Yeah. Oh, it's you are an amazing resource. And get his book, Sex Outside the Lines. Can they order it on your website or go to Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble.
All the places.
All the places.
All the places. Yes. Oh, cool. This is hot. I like the cover.
Well, that was a funny story. The original cover artwork was a white man and a white woman embracing. And I said, there is
no
way I'm doing that. Like, again, why is that the go-to? And so it was this big battle. And so we landed with this pink form that is most likely female and thin, but still vague. And I was kind of like, that was a battle I lost a little bit. I wanted a, you know, very diverse cover, but yeah.
Yep. It is pretty good. I mean, she's got big hands. Who knows?
There you go. Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. Thank you. Seriously. I needed time to diversify that.
No, it reminds me of Zoomanity.
Awesome.
Zoomanity.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, they...
it's a bad date I went on, but yeah.
Bad date?
On a bad date to that, but that's a whole other story.
Oh, man. I used to be obsessed. Anyway, sex and circus stuff.
Yes.
Okay, you and your adorable cat are just really just wonderful to hang out with.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for spending time.
Thank you for having me. I always have fun time with you.
Okay.
Smart stuff.
Go team fun. Thanks, Chris.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.